Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jim Slattery, and he'll be answering your questions on From the Catskills to the Madison River. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate if you'd share a podcast. And when you do, use hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it while you're listening to the show and let other people know about the great education we're giving fly fishers out here. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Jim Slattery about From the Catskills to the Madison. Enrico Puglisi Flies pride themselves with creating unique and one-of-a-kind flies and fly tying material. Enrico has been experimenting with durable synthetic and natural materials to create flies that catch fish for more than 30 years. His innovative products, including brushes, fibers, and components, have made a major impact on the direction of saltwater fly fishing, and his methods and materials are respected worldwide. Whether you want your flies hand-tied for you or you'd like to tie your own, be sure to visit Enrico Puglisi Flies and browse through their online catalog. Visit epflies.com and do a little shopping today. Again, that's epflies.com. Before we introduce Jim, I'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawings, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Jim's section that says Register for a Free Drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a book courtesy of Stackpole Books. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, pay attention, take notes, and hopefully you'll win that book courtesy of Stackpole Books. Our guest tonight is Jim Slattery. Jim is a distinguished figure in the world of fly fishing, renowned as the original creator of the Stimulator, a fly pattern that has become a staple in every angler's collection. With a deep-rooted passion for fly tying, Jim honed his craft in the Catskill tradition, training under the famous Dietz family in the New York Catskills. This rigorous apprenticeship endowed him with a parallel expertise, particularly in creating soft tackles and flips, using traditional silks and furs, following in the footsteps of fly legends like James Weissering and Pete Heide. For the past 15 years, Jim has been the owner and operator of Campfire Lodge, premier lodge and campsite located on the banks of the Madison River. Picturesque spot is one of the only three designated public use areas in Gallatin County, Montana, making it a treasured destination for fishing enthusiasts and nature lovers alike. Under Jim's stewardship, Campfire Lodge has flourished, offering guests an exceptional experience that combines world-class fishing with the serene beauty of the Montana wilderness. Jim also owns Jim's Fly Company, one of the largest brokers and distributors of whiting hackle in the world. His company is a testament to his dedication to quality and excellence in fly tying materials, serving a global community of fly tiers with the finest products available. So in addition to his business ventures, Jim is a committed conservationist serving as a board member of the Madison River Foundation. His contributions to fly fishing and his dedication to conservation have cemented his legacy as a master fly tier, innovative entrepreneur, and passionate steward of the natural world. Jim, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, well, thanks for taking time out of your busy season. I know we're right in the middle of it, and I appreciate you taking the time that we have tonight with us. So thank you so much. Well, plenty of things to talk about. First of all, folks, Jim was introduced to me by one of you. And when I reached out not too long ago to ask people, hey, who would you like me to interview? One of you recommended Jim, and we got connected, and here we are today. So if you have anybody that you would like to be interviewed on the show, send me the details, and we'll see if we can't get them on the show. So meanwhile, Jim, let's start at the beginning. You've had quite the life's adventure getting to where you are today. How did you get started in fly fishing?
Well, I grew up in New Jersey, not too far from the Musconetcong River, and I would see guys fly fishing, and I talked my mom into using our S&H green stamps, if those who remember those, to get me a fly fishing outfit.
Wow.
And, you know, I was probably 10 years old at the time. Yeah, it sounds about right. And I made a mess of it, but I tried. But, you know, without any proper instruction, you know, I struggled mightily. But I kept trying. And then when I was 13, I got the Knowles fly tying kit. And that turned out to be a disaster as well, but I still persevered. If anyone had got one of those Knoll kits, the vise wouldn't hold the hook, and the materials that they gave you did not imitate any of the insects that I saw crawling around in the water. So, you know, but I persevered, and that's really how I got started.
Wow.
Then,
wow.
Yeah, and not too long after that, I had a friend that lived on the Musconetcong, and he let me use his fly rod, and I had a light Cahill on there. The Cahills were hatching, and lo and behold, I caught my first fish on a fly rod, and that was cemented it, and been at it ever since.
So you started, am I correct, and you started tying before you started fishing with flies?
Well,
or about
a little bit after I got that fly rod set up, I started tying, but it didn't really work out too well. Yeah.
Okay. Did your friend tutor you, or was he your instructor at the time?
Well, not really. I just watched him closely, and he let me cast it once or twice. He goes, "You got it." And that was about it for the fishing aspect of it. The tying aspect of it was, had to be my sophomore year in high school, and we had a fly fishing club, and every Memorial weekend we would go up to the Catskills and fish the covered bridge section of the Upper Beaverkill, and it was quite an eye-opening experience. And we would have fly tying, you know, we'd meet weekly and have a fly tying session. And we learned new patterns, and that's where I really learned how to tie flies there. So
this was at the high school itself? It was a club in the high school?
It was a club in high school.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, it was very cool. And we go up to the mythical Beaverkill and stop in that, you know, the Deddy's and the Darby's fly shop, and it was quite the experience, you know, hallowed waters now, hallowed grounds.
Right, right. Yeah, I did a show recently this past year on the Beaverkill up there. Very interesting fishery up there. So, a lot of history. So did you then have mentors as time went on for tying flies?
Yeah, well, my first mentor was the teacher that actually ran the fly fishing club, and he taught me a lot. He was actually a friend of my dad's, family friend, and that's when I really learned how to tie under his tutelage, and it was quite an eye-opening experience, you know. And not soon afterwards, probably within about 6 months, I was pretty proficient at it and doing pretty well. And one day I went in there and I asked him, you know, what book should I read? I need to read a book about fly tying. And he told me to read The Art of Tying the Wet Fly by James Isenring. And it was cool, but, you know, in my mind, I already knew how to tie flies, you know, so I thought. And I read the book, and I go, well, the guys in the club, they showed me an easier way to do this, and the guys in the club showed me an easier way to do that. And, boy, was I ever wrong. I'm not really paying attention to what Leisinger was trying to tell us. But, you know, I cataloged that book, though, because my mentor said, there's only one book you ever read about it. This is the one. So, you know, I absorbed it, but I thought I had better ideas, you know, at the time, being just a 15-year-old kid. You know.
Do you remember what some of those differences were?
Well, you know, Leisinger tied without a bobbin holder and waxing the thread and just, you know, how we spun the bodies on the thread and, you know, that there was a way easier ways to do that. This was, you know, as my 15-year-old self, this is modern times and we can do things more modernly, you know. So, you know, those were a few of the different things, you know, and how Leisinger would also put the hackle on the hook first. You know, oh, I don't need to do that, you know, as a kid. That's how you think.
And were some of his techniques, did you go back to those later in life? And did you
think
the way that he did? Yeah.
Yeah, I did. You know, I was in my 30s, and I was revisiting my past and Leisinger ring, because I always used those patterns and they always worked to an extent. But once I started tying exactly the way Leisinger ring described it, I started catching bigger fish consistently. And that
there
was
you go.
Like the light,
that's what counts.
Right? Then the light goes on, ding! And then, you know, obviously at that point in my life, I got into a way, way deeper dive in the whole Leisinger ring, a method of tying and stuff. So, yeah, you know, so.
So what effect did the Dietz family have on your fly tying or your fishing?
The Daddies. That's the
Daddies. I'm sorry. Daddies.
That's okay. Yeah, that's okay. Well, interestingly enough, my story with the Daddies really starts being in that fishing club. So I had to been, it was, trying to think, it was probably my junior year. Yeah, it was my junior year in high school. And we went up to the Beaver Kill, and I caught the biggest fish, you know, on the trip of all, I think there was 8 or 10 of us there, and I caught the biggest fish. And that allowed me to go fishing on the main Beaver Kill with Roger George, who was the teacher that ran the club. And he would go up to the, every summer he would go up to the Butternut Grove on the main stem of the Beaver Kill, on the lower Beaver Kill. And that was a real eye-opener. So on our way there, I had been tying flies for already professionally. So at 16, about a year later when I really started, for the Oliver's Orbis shop in Clinton, New Jersey, which was a really cool shop. And I had met a tier there who tied for Harry Darby. And he said, here's my card. You go up and tell Harry Darby that I said that you should tie flies for him. So I went there and I spoke with Harry and we had a conversation. He wanted me to tie for him, but we couldn't agree to terms. So that's the best way to say it. Because, yeah, I was spoiled. I was spoiled at the Orbit shop where they would pay me $4.50 a dozen, and they were supplying all the materials for me, hooks. And, you know, I go up to the real world of Harry Darby, and he's like, yeah, $3 a dozen, and you supply all the materials. I'm like, yeah,
oh boy.
No, I'm not going to do that, you know. So our next stop was the Daddy shop. And in the shop, when we got there, Walt was there, Winnie was there, and Mary was there. And so I remember distinctly Mary was tying red quills. And, you know, I was just looking at the flies and just like drooling how superbly tied they were. And I come in there with my little box of flies for my, you know, this is my examples of what I do. And Walt comes out and looks at him. He goes, what the hell is wrong with all you kids? You all want to come up, grow up and be fly tires. There's no money being a fly tire. He goes, I'll tell you what, son, you look like you got some talent here. If you go to college, and when you go to college, you come in here and you can tie flies for us. But if you go to college, not tying flies for me. And that was my introduction to the Daddies.
Not too encouraging.
So, no, not very encouraging. But, you know, give me a dose of reality. You know?
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So years and years go by, and I was up there. I was working for XM Satellite Radio at that time, and I was flown out to New York. So I went up to Roscoe and met Mary again and was talking to her, and she became my mentor. I think it was 4 years in a row I had spent a week. Part of my vacation was going to Mary's shop there, and she took me in. She let me stay in one of the bedrooms, and I'd go downstairs and we'd tie flies all day together. And she'd tell me stories about the old days and what it was like, and really, really made me hone my skills for that Catskill style of tying. You know, I was pretty good. You know, I was pretty good tire. But once I learned the little intricacies that Mary was showing me, it took me to the next level, kind of
right,
opened the door.
Right. Could you give us a little background on the Daddies? You know, that was quite a while ago when you go back to Walt, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of maybe the younger fly fishers today might not know of them. So could you kind of give us a little background on that family?
Sure. Very interesting story. I'll try to share some of the stuff, but some stuff I can't.
Sure.
Walt Daddy was just a young lad and wanted to learn how to tie flies. And I guess the coolest story, sort of, is there was a tire by the name of Reuben Cross, who was the best tire in the area. And Walt wanted to learn how to tie flies from Rube, and he went to Rube's place, and he offered Rube $50. We're talking 1918, 1920, somewhere in that time frame. And he offered him $50 to teach him how to tie flies, and Rube said, "You go to hell." He wasn't going to teach him. And Walt said that he would not be competition for him. He would not start a, you know, fly tying business. But so Rube did sell him some flies. And, you know, my timeline might be off on that. I've been in the 20s, mid-20s, maybe that's more accurate, yeah. And so he went back home, and he was dating a gal by the name of Winnie Verdun, whose parents owned the Riverview Inn on the Beaverkill. So they were all, and then Harry Darby was part of the trio there, and they were over the old movie museum, and they started deconstructing Rube flies, and when he was taking the notes, writing the notes down. And that's basically how they learned how to tie, especially
wow.
the Rube Cross style. And the Rube Cross style, he pretty much codified the Catskill fly as we know it. You know, he's the one
oh,
that put the
okay.
stiff rooster, you know, hackle tail on it and cleaned it up a little bit. And so, yeah. But there's a side note to
yeah.
all this. There's a side note to this. This is about Winnie. I mean, she was a highly, highly intelligent person. She had an IQ of like 165. It was like off the charts. But the famous Hendrickson fly was actually first tied by Roy Steenrod at the Riverview Inn that Winnie's parents had owned. So she had to have been about 10 years old when that was happening then.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing her intelligence, she was probably there watching and picking up everything. And she actually started selling flies when she was 13 there. She actually had a little fly bin over there. And not many people know that. It's not part of folklore, but it's true. Yeah, so, you know, on a side note, going off tangent here, it's interesting how a woman that intelligent just kind of demurred to her boyfriend. You know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
pretty unique kind of thing. So anyway, I digress.
So so Walt and Winnie got married, and Mary was their daughter. Is that, do I have
yep.
that correct? Yeah.
That's correct. Yep. And they started, so here's another tie-in. Interestingly enough, Walt and Winnie got married, and then they started to run the Riverview Inn. But then, and Walt started raising birds, hackle birds there.
Oh.
Yeah. And then the Great Depression hit, and I guess Winnie's dad had kind of leveraged out the place. But the bank wanted them to stay there, but Walt might have had maybe a little too much pride. He said, no, you take the place back. You take the bank, take the place. And they moved, and he gave all the birds away to local farmers that would take them that he had. And then once he got a new place to live and got on his feet, he went back that he could raise their chickens. He went back to all the farmers and bought back the chickens that he had given them. And a lot of the farmers wanted to just give them to him, but Walt said, no, he fed them for 2 years or a year and a half, whatever it was. I need to pay you for that. So he was a man of integrity. And
sounds like it.
Yeah, just a straight shooter, you know.
Yeah. So is that what kind of got you into the, you know, with that group, getting into the soft hackles and flimps and that kind of, that style of tying?
No, it wasn't the daddies, because they were dry fly people. That's what they, you
okay.
know, they obviously tied wet flies and stuff, but their main legacies with the dry fly, and Walt came up with the coffin fly and a series of other stuff. So,
okay. Let's come back to that in just a minute. I have to take a quick break, and
sure.
we'll continue on and get ready to talk about your pride and joy, the stimulator. So hang tight, everybody. We'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jim Slattery about Catskills to the Madison. If you'd like to ask Jim a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com. Use that Q&A text box and send us your question. Okay, Jim. So you did have an interest in soft tackles and flimps, right? Well, that was a sweet spot for you?
Yes. Well, that would have been from my mentor, Roger George, having me read that book on Leisingring.
Okay, that's where that came from. Okay, good. What were, you know, as your skills grew, what were some of the biggest challenges you faced while perfecting your fly tying skills?
Well, I think the biggest ones, especially, let's say, tying a collared dry fly in the Catskill style, and I think it, like most people, would be proportions and not crowding the eye, you know. That seemed, you know, and all the typical things that hamper someone learning how to tie, putting on too much dubbing and proportions. I think the other thing that was sourcing materials and getting especially good hackle, dry fly hackle, that was always a challenge. We're always using the Indian necks. And you know, you'd have to tie two or three of those on there to get it to look right. So, you know, accessing material was always a challenge back then.
You know? Right, yeah. I remember I started tying flies when I was in junior high school and really didn't know anything about feathers and stuff. It was, you know, kind of a crude start. But I remember my friend and I drove our spider bikes out to a chicken farm to see if we could get any feathers. And the farmer, you know, he had a whole big warehouse full of chickens. And he says, yeah, a few die here every day. Here's a couple of dead ones. And we rode back on our spider bikes, holding the chickens by their necks on the way home to pluck them. Later on, you know, there was, like, the feathers were all white, and they're kind of used. They were good for maybe some tails or something, but that was about it. But anyway, it was a funny story. We didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah,
but you got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, that's not unsimilar to me. You know, I would go to the local farms and buy their chickens from them, you know, and then I'd process them, and the hackle was always junk, but you always had the high hopes that these were good, you know.
Yeah. I remember we were probably tying about the same point in time. So, and information and materials were both hard to get back then, you know? Like it is today. Yeah. So.
Yeah, you had to read the book and try to figure out exactly what the heck they were talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's talk about the stimulator as it's known today. When did you first tie that? And what problem were you trying to solve?
Sure. Well, I first started tying that was probably 1980.
We lost you there for a few minutes, yeah. So, continue on.
I'm out here in the wilderness. Sometimes, you know, we have spotting signal out here, so.
Okay, anyway. So you were just starting to tell us, you know, when you started tying the stimulator, when it came about, and why it came about.
Yeah, that was 1980, and I was on the Musconetcong River, and it was around May, and I was at the no-kill stretch on the Musconetcong, right in Hackettstown, New Jersey, actually. And I noticed these fish rising, and I was like, oh, what's going on? And all of a sudden, I see these gigantic stoneflies. And the East Coast, we have the giant eastern stonefly. It's pretty big fly. It's probably about an inch and a half long. And I saw them ovipositing on the water, and I saw them being eaten by really, really hard fish to catch. So I captured one and put it in my pocket and went home and started trying to imitate it. So that's really how it came to be.
Mm-hmm. And what did you, you originally called it by a different name, right?
Yeah, after I had tied it up, I called it the fluttering stonefly because that's what I was watching. I was watching fluttering females ovipositing on the water. So that's what I tried to imitate. Obviously, back then, we didn't have hooks that had a bent shaft. or shaft or anything like that, curved, you know. So I took a size 10 6X streamer hook, and I bent it to shape.
Oh, good.
And then, yeah, so then the other problem, one of the problems we had on that stretch of water where I saw those bugs was that if you had an oil ring on your dry fly, they would not come up. They'd come up and look at it and just swim away. So the task at hand is, how do I make this fly float and stay floating without using floating on it? Now, I remember back in those days, there was an inchworm fly, if you remember that. It was made out of deer hair, and basically was kind of tied at the end and kind of gathered, wrapped around the hook, and deer hair is what made the fly float. So not having any access to closed cell foam back then, and I actually tried using the foam that was in the sofa. I opened up the I unzipped the cloth around the sofa pillow and I cut some of that out, and I tied it on the fly, and it dutifully sunk to the bottom of the glass of water, so I knew that was going in the wrong direction. So
right.
I went back to using the deer, and that's basically what I did. I was like that inchworm. I gathered, tied it off halfway. Well, not, you know, originally, the first version, I tied it in thirds, two-thirds of the body, and then the last third was the thorax and half of it. But that didn't work out too well once I turned it over. And that's kind of how the stimulator, as you see it today, is tied. But when I flipped it over, it was not imitating that giant stone. So I went back to the drawing board, and I tied in the deer hair halfway up the hook shank. And then I gather wrapped it and then tied it in tight, like at the end and in the middle and by the tail as well. And I stacked the tail. And then over that, I left a piece of thread, well, actually very fine wire, gold wire at that point, and I dubbed on the body very, very tightly, but not very big, very tightly and fine, and wound that up through the body of the fly, and I tied on a hackle and wound it back to the tail, and that was a brown, yeah, I'm pretty sure that was a brown saddle hackle from one of the birds that I had killed that we had talked about. And then I wound the wire up through the body. And then at that point, I tied in the wing, and initially I stacked it, but I didn't like the way that it looked. It looked like it wasn't fluttering. That's what I was trying to do. I was trying to make it look like it was alive. And
right.
This is where the Leisinger ring comes back into play. Because if you ever read Leisinger's book, one of his big things is about making the bug look alive, or making it, you're trying to imitate the bug's actions. So instead of stacking the tail, I just cut the deer hair and didn't stack it. And that left, you had the long fibers and you had short fibers as it went up, and it looked more realistic. It looked more like a fly, you know, a stone fly's wings fluttering. So that's what I did there. And then same thing that I did with the body, I did the same treatment to the thorax area and the head. And then I dubbed that, you know, back at the eastern stoneflies, they have two different colors. The bodies are underneath, and that's what I'm imitating, the color of the underneath the fly, because that's what the fish are going to see. They're like a mustardy olive the body, and then the thorax, though, is more like a mustardy orange. So I dubbed the body. Then I tied the hackle in like a Palmer fashion through the thorax. And on the original one, the first one I tied that to the eye, like as you see the stimulator, as it morphed into something else. But I didn't like that. And then again, I had the underside of the fly, that's what I'm looking at. That big old head on those stoneflies is just sticking out there and looking scary. So that's what I did. I stopped the hackle about, I don't know, two-thirds up there or something like that, and tied it off, and then I dubbed the head on it. And that's how it came to be. Now, that fly was... So here's the story of how it left my hands and went to the West Coast. Around that same time, the local TU chapter, or a TU chapter, decided that they wanted to put three pairs of brown trout for spawning. They had found where I lived in Stevensburg, there was some natural springs coming up there, and it was very cold water. So they had the idea, if they put three spawning pairs in there, that maybe they would spawn. You know, adult browns, that the hopes were they would spawn. And they put them in there in late June, which is when most people are done fishing, the mid-June, late June, on the Musconetcons. And they called them in. They asked me to make sure that nobody would, you know, just kind of protect it best I could and let the word out, don't kill the fish or trying to have them spawn. Well, at that same time, there was a kid, a friend of mine, who had just got his first fly rod. And so I gave him, he goes, my dad gave me some money to buy flies off of you. I said, okay, well, let me give you some flies. And I gave him one of those stimulators, or fluttering stones, as I called it back then. And I told the kid, look, now downstream, you might catch some fish down. There's some big fish. Let them go. They're trying to make them so they spawn. Well, he was like, I don't know, 15 years old, and he caught every one of them suckers and brought them home. So,
oh, no.
And he caught him on the stimulator. I said, well, what'd you catch him on? I got him on that big fly of yours. I said, oh, well, my mind, I'm going, well, it works, you know. And so I got a phone call about soon after. The guys at the TUN went down to the river and those fish were gone. And then I proceeded to tell them the story of what fly was used. And they were like, well, you know, at least we got a new fly fisherman now. He's hooked, you know. So that was the silver lining. So about a couple weeks later or so, I got a phone call from him and said, hey, we're going out west, and we want to see your flies and your salmon flies, because I had sold flies to these guys. So I went and met them, and they kept saying, well, let's see your salmon flies. And I had told them, I said, look, I don't tie salmon flies, because I'm thinking, you know, Atlantic salmon flies. And the barber shop wanted me to start tying those, and they gave me double hooks, and I didn't have the patience for it. So that's why I said, I don't tie salmon flies. And then the one guy said, no, you're stonefly imitation. So I had them in a different box, and I handed it to them. They didn't want to have nothing to do with them. They said, dear, these things are ugly. They will not catch fish. Nothing, you know. They didn't want them. So I said, so it kind of pissed me off, you know. It was like, well, I know these flies work. So I said, here, you take these flies. You don't have to pay them for me. I want you to do some R&D out west with these flies and see if they work. And, you know, well, what do you call it? And then, well, I settled upon the name of the stimulator, after, at that time, I was in a punk rock band playing in New York City, and had a friend's band that was called the Stimulators, and I named it after their band. So that's where the name for the tonight came from.
Yeah. Punk rock band. Punk rock band.
And that's a whole nother. That's a whole nother story. That.
Oh, okay.
good and okay, bad well, and ugly.
Good and bad and ugly. Yeah, yeah. Well, what years was that? Just I won't dig into it too far.
1982, well, actually 1979, late 79 to,
disbanded
83. We couldn't get out of our own way. I mean, we had A&M Records wanting to sign us. We had the opportunity to play on Saturday Night Live, but.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
They didn't, the guys in the band felt that they weren't getting paid enough. And I was. at a club in New York, and I had this guy named Bill had befriended me at the bar, and he had seen our band and really liked us, and he came up to me and said one day, hey, I got a friend that does the bookings on Saturday Night Live. He's heard your 45, and he wants, under my recommendation, he wants you to play on Saturday Night Live, but you gotta talk to him. So I told the guys that, the most that they're gonna pay us is $500, and they were like, no, we're on national TV, we need to get more. And I told Warren Michaels, who's the guy who I was negotiating with, who I had no idea who he was, and Warren said, look, son, I don't care if you're the effing Rolling Stones, you're only going to get paid $500. So you better go over there and tell these guys that's what the deal is. And I went over and they said, no, we want X. And Warren said, well, good luck.
Yeah, yeah. But, sounds like your buddies couldn't see the long game there, huh? Yeah.
No, they could not. No, they were no. And the guy Bill was actually Bill Murray.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was Bill Murray. Well, I didn't know, and he kept trying to tell me who he was, and I'm some kid from the sticks, I'm out there, and I'm not smart enough to know that these are where these kind of people go and hang out. I heard rumors of it, but,
Yeah,
so anyway, I digress. That's my punk rock story, and that's all. So I'm going to say it.
Okay. Well, let's take a quick break, and then let's come back and talk about fishing the Stimulator. We want to get some. We've got a bunch of questions come in about that, so we'll pick up there in just a few seconds here. Discover the power of pure Skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, from delicate soft tackles to heavy. FD Steelhead Flies, OPST's versatile casting system, meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead, trout, or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit pureskagit.com. Again, pureskagit.com, or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jim Slattery about Catskills to the Madison River. If you'd like to ask Jim a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, fill out that Q&A box, and send it over, and we'll see if we can't get an answer. Okay, Jim, some questions. First, before I forget, have you made a video or instructions for tying your version of, the original Stimulator? Because I know, like you said, it's kind of morphed through different hands over the years, and I was wondering if, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
No, I did film one, but the audio was wasn't working. It didn't work out too well because I was doing it, and there was a loud cooler going on, so it didn't make it a lot of noise.
Okay.
So no, I have not. I need to. That's something that I'm going to do this off season. The stimulator. I mean, interestingly enough, on that fly, the guys that I sent it, that I gave it to, that went out west, they said they were going to the Miracle Mile. So we kind of zeroed that into someplace in Wyoming, but I don't know. I don't, you know, I was oblivious to anything out west back then, except for I'd been there and wanted to go back.
Yeah.
But I got a phone call from them, and they said, hey, what kind of hooks are you using on these flies? I go, well, they're mustads. And they go, well, they keep straightening out. I go, well, how many fish are you catching on these things? I go, they go, you know, 20, 30 fish on the fly. I go, wow. And I'm thinking to myself, well, the hook should have still held up, you know. And I go, well, how big are these fish? Oh, you know, 24 inches or bigger. And then they would just laugh. But the fly worked very, very well. It saved their trip, apparently. They were fishing the guide flies that were given to them, and they were having moderate to slow success.
And so forth. So it worked, right? It worked.
It worked.
In
the
Wyoming,
main thing, it worked.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You know, what's funny is before I ever knew what the stimulator was imitating, I used to use it on lakes as an attractor fly when nothing else would work.
Mm-hmm.
And I would catch fish on the surface. I think they thought it was a grasshopper or something, a big bug. But it was like my go-to fly when all else failed. I'd tie on a stimulator and throw it in a lake and catch fish. So there you go. Who knows? Who knows?
Well, you know, there's giant caddis and some lakes, even stoneflies hatch.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably what it was imitating.
Yeah. Jerry Crow from New Hampshire wrote in, and he says, do you ever twitch or skate it, or do you just dead drift it?
Well, all three. Do all three. And another thing you can actually do is you can tuck it under and let it go subsurface, and it'll catch them.
Oh, really?
When it's swinging, you'll get some violent hits. So,
interesting. Never tried that. Yeah, yeah. Truck in Placerville, California, she says, what conditions do I look for that would be the best time for me to tie on a stimulator?
Well, you talk to some people, that's the only fly they use. But, you know, you're looking for if the stoneflies are out on the water, and if you're fishing the smaller ones down to 14s and 16s, people time that small, they're great caddis imitators as well. So.
Okay. Okay, works for caddis as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
go ahead.
Well, the original, you know, my version still works very well out on the Madison. I've had the same fish come up three times and hit on it, and I missed every time, but, you know, those things happen. A friend of mine from, where is he from? Tennessee, he came out here. He's actually a really good guide out here now. The biggest fish that he's ever caught on the Madison, he caught with my version of the stimulator during the salmon fly hatch. It was he's either 26 or 27 inch brown.
Oh wow, yeah.
So it still works. Yeah. That was just a couple years ago, so it still works. I was out with it the other day, and it still works.
Do you find that it works when there's no stonefly hatch happening? I mean, you know, on the shoulder sides of a hatch as well.
I think it can. I think, you know, it'll work as a, you know, with the right colors, it'll work as a hopper imitation for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Okay. Any other tips you can give us about using it, or?
Fish it with confidence.
Yeah, I do. That seems to work. Your buddy James in Idaho wrote in and he says that he asked, he's asking you to name five types of traditional flies that are underutilized in Western fishing scenarios. Describe when these flies should be used and the techniques that should be employed.
Okay, well, the first fly that comes to my mind, I have a friend from the East Coast that I met through the Daddies. His name is Dick Despommier. He was a professor at Columbia University, and he came out here and he stayed with us, and he was out there fishing Au Sable wolves, where there was no, and he was crushing it. So there's a fly that works out here for sure. They were probably taking it for more than likely for a, and he was fishing red quills as well, both, and they were probably for the rusty spinners, more than likely the PMDs. They were size 16, so that fly works tremendously well. Those flies work very well. The other fly, it has it's called the Lysing Ring Spider, and basically it's a hare's ear with some gold rib and partridge wrapped around the front. That works, always works. See what other Eastern flies, traditional flies. I think a fly that's been forgotten that works tremendously well is the just a tam parachute hopper, and we're in hopper season out here. That fly does not disappoint. I would give a tip though, if you're, well, I guess you're going to be having a problem anyway, but if the store-bought flies, generally the hackles are too short and on the fly. So what I do is I take that fly and I'll put it on, I'll just wind some bigger hackle on it. I'll leave the hackle that's already on it, but then I'll put bigger hackle on it. It floats like a top when you do that.
Interesting. Well, let's move on because the title of the show is From Catskill to the Madison. So we need to get to the Madison. When did you leave the East Coast and did you move directly to Montana or did you go to the West Coast? What was your journey and how did you get there?
Well, I was living in Jersey, and my son and I decided to move to California. My mom was out there, and being a single dad, it just seemed to be a natural fit. It worked out really well, and I met a lot of nice people out there, and I met my wife out there, my current wife out there. And I landed a job. I'm a carpenter by trade, essentially. I've done other things too, but I landed a job with a display manufacturer and for car audios and stuff like that, and started doing trade shows, and I landed the more instrumental in landing the XM satellite radio display trade, and we did their trade shows. So that was, that's kind of what I did out when I got out there, and got to a point where they were going to merge with Sirius Radio and wanted to do something different. And that time when I was a kid and went to Butternut Grove, that burned deeply in my brain. That's what I wanted to do. So I talked to my then girlfriend and said, "Hey, I want to do a lodge and a camp, a lodge with a maybe do breakfast and lunch and be on a river and open up a fly shop." And we were searching, and one day we found Campfire Lodge, and The rest is history.
Now, when did you start Jim's Fly Company? Was it before you got the lodge, or when you got the
lodge
at the
same
time?
Well, Jim's Fly Company, I started back in, had to be 1970.
Oh, way back, yeah.
75, 76, when I was tying flies for Orvis and,
oh,
you know, the guys that, like, from the TU chapter and stuff. I started my own little company called Jim's Custom Flies. And then that, you know, just morphed out to Jim's Fly Company. It's kind of the same thing. So that's when I first started. And, you know, kind of interesting side story here is, remember, I think it was my 16th birthday, and I talked my mom into taking me out to Raymond C. Rumpf. That's a name known on the East Coast, who's a fly tying materials guy. He was like the guy,
okay.
You know, other than you know, especially for professional, you know, pro tires, or, you know, whatever you would call that. And I went out there, and I wanted to buy some necks, and he went out and picked a couple out of the barrel and handed it to me. And I said, well, can't I pick them out myself? And he goes, oh, you want to pick them out yourself? He goes, go ahead. So that's kind of a little side story on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hooked on hackle deeply after that.
Yeah, yeah, you appreciated good hackle. Yeah. So you were just kind of selling them, you know, to people you knew. I mean, obviously, or were you doing mail order, or how were you selling?
No, I was just the high school kid. And then
okay.
When I, you know, I would pitch my wares at the no-kill stretch on the Musconetcong, and I got a few customers. I would sell them hackle, and, you know, they were encouraging. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. kind of my start. Obviously, as I got older, things changed. You know, you couldn't make a living doing that.
Well, so. But you have a, you know, a big presence now with your fly shop, right? I mean, you're one of the bigger distributors of whiting. And when did that happen?
Well, that started in, I think that started in about 99. And I got an account with them, and then they
but
asked
that was
me
before,
if I wanted to.
That was before you bought the Campfire Lodge, though, right?
Oh yeah, way
yeah,
know,
okay,
way before, yeah. And I, mm-hmm. you know, I started an online business at that point. I had a website and had
okay,
some
you went right on
it.
To online. Okay, okay, good.
Yeah, because I saw that was the future, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, so I was able
and
to,
then,
you know, do well. Go ahead.
So that became part of Campfire Lodge then, right? I mean, you have a fly shop there now, and you have another fly shop, right?
Yeah, we have, yeah. So, yeah, that morphed right into Campfire Lodge very well. And then I live in Idaho Falls in the wintertime, so.
Mm-hmm.
I found this building in Idaho Falls that was a really good buy, and I bought it, and I moved the internet business, you know, the winter internet business, out of my basement into the shop.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. And is that a place that's open to the public, or just for warehousing and shipping?
No, it's open to the public. We're an Orvis dealer.
Oh.
We're a Hardy
okay.
dealer. You know,
okay.
Orvis is new, but that kind of ties back to the beginning for me being professional
right.
tire with the Orvis shop.
Right.
So I like that. And, you know, we have most of the major brands there, you know. So, yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, it's
yep.
a cool shop.
What are the website or the different websites that you have that people should go to find you and what you're doing?
Well, we have the, you know, if you want to stay on the Madison River in Montana, and one of the best stretches of the river, and it's, that would be Campfire Lodge, westyellowstone.com.
Okay.
And then the online fly shop is jimsflyco.com.
jimsflyco.com. Okay. All right. Good. Good. Well, tell us about the Campfire Lodge. You said you were searching. How did you find, you know, that it was available? And
well, it was just sheer luck, really. I mean, well, some people might say the opposite, but I had been out on the road with the XM, and I got back, and I was told that I had the next week off. When nobody had told me, that was like on a Friday night or Thursday, and I had the next week off. And we, my girlfriend and I, had been out to Idaho and Montana the year before, looking around to see if we could find what were, you know, campground on the river and something that we can turn into something. So when I was out there, I was in St. Regis, and I was fishing, and I was fishing with this guy, and they had just come back, and they said that they were in fishing the Madison down by West Yellowstone, and they were crushing it because they hit the salmon fly hatch. So with this short window, and I had met Bob Jacklin too, and the East Coast,
oh, yeah.
he got inducted into the Catskill Hall of Fame there. And I had met him. I was sitting with Mary Deddy and Joan Wolf at the dinner, and that's when I kind of met him. So anyway, I called him, and he told me to come out there and sell me a couple maps, and he would put circles around where all the good fishing spots were. And while I went in there, and he did that, and very gracious man. And then I asked him, I said, Bob, if there's just one spot that you could fish out of all these spots that you've identified for me, where would you go? And he wouldn't say where it was, but he just pointed his finger down on the map. He goes, that's where I start. That's where I go. He goes, and that's where I fish. So that turned out to be Fire Lodge on between the lakes.
Oh, wow. Wow. Wow.
So that's kind of how I discovered it. And, you know, he told me that if you pick a spot on the river, if you're going to be here for any length of time, like a week, whatever, pick a spot on the river that you like, section of the river you like, and you just stay there for the week and fish it and learn it. And he said, if you're any kind of fly fisherman, by the end of the week, you'll be catching a lot of fish and you'll be catching some big fish. And he was 100% right. So in my bliss of catching nice fish, I called my girlfriend, my wife, now, and said, hey, you tell your employer, she worked for the county, I said, you tell him you want the first 2 weeks of July off. And you got to come out here and see this. This is unbelievable out here on the river. And she did, and I informed my employer that I was taking 2 weeks off, and I said, if you didn't like it, fire me. And they didn't. But so we were out here, and we had like two more days to go, and we just fell in love with the area. I mean, it's so beautiful out here, and so especially back then, there was hardly that many people out here. And so I said, well, let's go to the real estate agent and see what kind of businesses they have for sale around here. You know, we had our mindset on a, you know, campground, but, you know, we didn't see any available. Well, as it turns out, it was at the bottom of the last page, it said 155 Campfire Lane. I said, well, that's where we're staying.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
Huh, interesting.
I was like a pit bull on a bone. There was no shaking me, getting that bone out of my mouth. So
yeah, yeah. Well, tell us a little bit. Yeah, tell us about the history of Campfire Lodge, because it has some history, right?
Oh yeah,
a few
it
minutes.
does.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was established in 1921, so it's actually one of the oldest facilities of this sort in the area. And it was built below Hebgen Dam between the two lakes. And then in 1959, there was a big earthquake that happened, and it formed an earthquake dam down that's about 6 miles down the road. And so for the fly fisherman and the angler, it offers a micro environment here. It's like it's different than anywhere else because you have two streams that come in here. You have Cabin Creek, which is directly upstream from us, and then down below there's Beaver Creek, which is these are hefty creeks. It's Beaver Creek in particular. So not only do we have the cold water coming out of the dams here, we also have this clean, cold, ice cold water coming down from the mountains on these creeks. So it makes for a micro environment here, and it's unique. It's the only thing I can say. Bob Jacklin says this is the best mile and a half in the state of Montana.
Oh, nice.
So
Yeah.
it's, things have changed over the years. There's a little bit more fishermen out here now, but the fishing's still good. There was a young man that came in the other day, about a week ago, had a really nice fish on that. They couldn't get it in the net. He didn't get to touch it, but it was a big brown.
Yeah,
So they're
yeah.
in here.
But what
And,
was the history behind the lodge?
well, as far as we can tell, and this is just extrapolation or just kind of guessing. And I think it was from 1911 to 1913 or 14, they built the dam at Hebgen Lake. And they had quite a few people out here. And we kind of think maybe that this was a spot where the workers had lived or, camped
Oh.
out at. Because there was a lot of people out here. They had hundreds of people that were working on the dam in the summertime. So that's kind of how we think it might have got developed at a rough development. And then in 1921, a lady by the name of Miller, her last name was Miller, she started the Campfire Lodge. And through the years, it's changed hands and ownerships and developed into what it is today. You
And
know,
what
you
do you,
have you.
I was going to say, what do you offer your guests there? What
Well,
facilities do you have? Perfect.
we have creekside or river and creekside cabins. I mean, they're directly on the river, and RV sites and campsites. We have public laundry and shower house that's pretty nice, and we also have a cafe and a fly shop. The cafe's been pretty well renowned for its breakfast and lunch. We've had people parked up to the highway, and we had them 50 people deep in the wait list trying to get in.
Wow.
So,
Jeez.
we put out a pretty good product. That goes back, partially that goes back for me anyway. My first real job I had when I was 11 years old. My dad worked at the best restaurant in Hackettstown, New Jersey, and the dishwasher didn't show up. So they called me up on Easter. They called my mom on Easter, said, "Bring the kids down. We need help." So I was washing dishes, and I was a small kid. I mean, I was like shoulder height to the table where they had all the dishes in it. But I kind of cut my teeth on being in restaurants. And I worked as a senior in high school. I actually cooked in that restaurant. Not every day, but once or twice a week. So I
Yeah,
kind of knew
yeah.
that. So that ties into the restaurant here.
Sure,
Come
sure.
if my dad had a restaurant in later life. So I just kind of grew up in it. So I was able to transfer those skills over to here and tighten some things up and make it a little bit more consistent.
Yeah.
And it seems
yeah.
the
Great.
Customers seem to like it.
Yeah, it seems like a wonderful place. I'll have to drop in there sometime. But we need to finish up here. We're about out of time. You know, you've had quite a few mentors over the years. Maybe you can give us your insights or recommendations to people that are just getting started and, you know, in fly fishing or tying, and maybe give them some tips on, you know, looking for mentors or mentorship or that kind of thing. Can you kind of close things out with that?
Sure. I think go to your local fly shop. I mean, there's a wealth of information there. I mean, obviously it's on YouTube and everywhere else. But I think if you really want real hands-on, go to your local fly shop, and, you know, chances are there's one or two fly tying wizards there, and they can help you along. The other thing that I would highly suggest is that you go out and try to find that Jim Weisenring book, The Art of Tying the Web Fly. Because in that book, it's a small book, but in that book, he tells you, he's not really big on giving you specific patterns, although there are some in there and recipes for them. It's more educational about how you want to learn how to tie flies. You want to learn to tie flies that look like the insects in the water that you're fishing, in the color and shape. And also, the key component is mimicry. How would imitate the actions of the fly at the stage of its life that you're trying to replicate and that the fish are eating. You know, it's a unique book. And he talks about one of his big things is fur bodies with silk thread, and you blend the dubbing and the thread. The thread will give the dubbing an overtone or undertone. So it'll look like more like a real insect. So if you have, let's say, an orange body thread, and you put over that like a cream body, and you dip that in the water, and you dub it right, you look at it in the light or in the sunshine, it'll look just like a real insect, a real mayfly. And that, in my view, is that's how you... I like to tell people that's how you catch the pig in the pool. Because that fish has not gotten big and smart by being stupid.
Right.
And it's
exactly.
looking at it,
yeah.
it's inspecting those flies as it comes down. So if you have the right silhouette, you have the right color, the right action, you can even just hackle can impart action on these flies.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Softer hackle for soft water, stiffer hackle for fast water. Yeah, these are all the things that he's teaching you in the book. I highly, highly recommend it.
Yeah,
highly.
Hard to get out there. I just looked it up on Amazon. It's going for $70, $80 now, used.
Yeah. Well, there is a silver lining, though. Pete Heide's son, Lance Heide, is actually working on a... revised edition that'll be more informative. Yeah, so, you know, he's been working on it for a while, and I'm glad that he's taking his time, because the longer he takes, the more information that he's getting, and the more precise the book will be. It's going to be a great book.
Sounds like it. Well, great. That's great advice, and unfortunately, we got to wrap things up here. When we return, we're going to give away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a membership to the Trout Unlimited, and also a book courtesy of Stackpole Books. So stick with me here, Jim. I want you to be involved in our little contest here, and a few more things to do and give away, and then we'll wind things up. So hang tight. Another short announcement, and we'll do those prize giveaways here in just a moment. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. And just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away some prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show so you have a chance at winning one of these great prizes. If you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show to collect your information so that we can deliver your prize to you. So first, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. To learn more about Fly Fishers International, go to flyfishersinternational.org, and you can learn all about FFI there. Great organization to support, so check them out. Our winner for that is Tyler Tipton in Alabama. Tyler Tipton in Alabama. So congratulations, Tyler, and thanks for playing here tonight. Now we'll give away a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Learn more about Trout Unlimited. Go to TU.org, TU.org, another great organization to support. And our winner for that is Mark Smeltzer in Oregon, Mark Smeltzer in Oregon. So congratulations to both of you, and thanks for playing. And I just wanted to say tonight that, Jim, really appreciate you being on the show with us. A pleasure to talk to you. It was so much fun, and thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. Now, hopefully all of you have found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link on the top line menu. In the archive, you will find all of our past shows, over 390 shows, which you can search by keyword or keyword phrase, like trout, tarpon, Madison River, and so on. So just go ahead and explore. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you find. Our next broadcast will be on August 21st at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, I'll interview Sam Johnson, and our show is on fly fishing Virginia's Blue Ridge Parkway. Sam is an expert angler. He shares his secrets of fly fishing along the Blue Ridge Parkway in Virginia, and you'll discover all the best fly fishing spots on Blue Ridge Parkway's 217 miles in Virginia. You'll learn about the unique strategies, techniques that make this region a fly fisher's paradise. Whether you're a seasoned angler or new to the sport, Sam's wealth of knowledge and captivating stories will inspire and guide you on your next adventure. And we'll see you there. Now, we'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish Tarpon Trust, Stackpole Books, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Enrico Puglisi Flies for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.